Hi, everybody. My name is Bash Rabinowski. I'm an alcoholic. Test the grace of our loving God, working through the fellowship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink of alcohol since March 31st, 1986. So I'm thankful for that. And without any further ado, our topic this morning is Principles Before Personalities. And we're going to start with Lloyd Kay from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada.
Thank you. And I am Lloyd Kay, and I am from Winnipeg, Manitoba, area, 80. And I am an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. And you know this, I want to thank the people responsible for making it that I could get here today and share with you. And that's all I really want to do is share with you. And some of those people are, of course, Rick, who sent out the letters, and my friend Johnny J., who submitted my name. And I'm grateful for that. It's a wonderful opportunity, and I never, ever dreamt that I would ever be at a place like this, speaking to you people, you good people. But this disease of alcoholism is just something else. And it's horrendous. And let's say where I come from, if you shake that family tree, you give a little shake, sure as heck, one will fall out. And sometimes you give it a real good shake, the whole family will fall out. And you know what? I bet I know how each and every one of you got here. Somewhere along the line, somebody said to you, "Don't you think you drink just a little bit too much?" And you said, "Oh, thank you for drawing that to my attention. I'll go to AA tomorrow." And I know darn well that's not how we get here. We go to great lengths to prove them wrong. We go into training. Alcoholics train hard. And I want to say this. I'm also grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. You people, you're AA, not this room. When you leave this room, there's no more AA. You are AA. And I enjoy a good life today. And actually, it's hard to believe I am where I am today. My bride and I are going to be married 50 years this year. I'm a great-grandfather. And I never thought that would happen to me. When I came to you great people, I was 33 years old. So I've been very fortunate. I'm blessed. And I often wonder about the disease of alcoholism. It has interested me, and I've done a lot of thinking about it. I've heard speakers say, "You know what, I think I was born an alcoholic." And I say, "What does that mean? That mean you come out of that womb sucking on a bottle or something?" I don't think so. But I believe this, and this is just my opinion. It's not AA's opinion, but it's mine. I believe this. It says it's a progressive illness, always getting worse, never better. And it doesn't matter if you're drinking or not. It's progressing. And it progressed for me, always getting worse. And I think, you know, like to start a fire, you got to have a certain criteria. And that criteria is you got to have some fuel. And you got to have some oxygen. And you got to have a spark to have a fire. And I believe for alcoholics like Lloyd, that criteria, I have it in here. It's an X factor. We don't know what it is. And we need a spark to set it off. And what is that spark? Alcohol. And like I said, I was getting worse, and you might say, "Well, I know if I started drinking, I would go back worse than where I was." And how do I know that? Because of our big book. Well, the story about the man that was sober 25 years, pulled out his carpet slippers, pulled out the bottle, retired, and thought he would take it easy and drink a few drinks, I guess. And what happened to that man? Within a few short months, he was hospitalized after 25 years sobriety. So it says something. It says, "You're not going to get any good time." That's what it says. And within 4 years, that poor man was dead. This is a serious illness. And you know, I don't remember as a kid sitting on my mother's lap, my mother saying, "Well, Lloyd, what are you going to be when you grow up?" And me saying, "You know, Mom, I think I'll be an alcoholic." Doesn't happen like that either. I came from a good home. There was no alcoholics in my family. Maybe it jumped a generation, but I believe this. The apple never falls too far from the tree. I really believe that. But anyway, I was like most people. It says in the book, we drink like, or we act like most normal men when we're not drinking. You know what? I was normal till about the time I was 16, and I was the father of my daddy's eye. But at 16, I was introduced to John Barleycorn, and I loved it, and it was my instant relief. It made me what I wanted to be. I liked the effect that it gave me. It made me feel better or superior, things like that. Took a little shyness out of me. But I was a problem drinker right from the start. I just didn't grow into it. The first time I got really loaded, we went to a school dance. I was a young kid. And somebody asked if I knew where there was some liquor available. I said, "Yeah, I know a bootlegger." And we went there. We got a 40-ouncer, and I think I mixed the first one after that. I was drinking it straight, and of course, what really happened is I passed right out. And I was quite a pass-out artist at one time. They'd always say, "Where's Lloyd at the party?" "He'll say, he's passed out." That's where I would be. And it was always a problem. But you know, I again now act like most people since I got sober. So it's true what they say. I act just like other people now. And I have some respect in my family. We have some unity and things like that. But when I started drinking too, I was a young kid. In my day, they had these teen dances where you'd all go and dance. You'd pull up there and couldn't take any liquor in. We were all underage. I was maybe 17 at that time. So we'd split a 24 of beer, box of beer. Four guys or six guys would get four of beer. I would just wallop them back. That's the kind of drinker I was. And by the time I finished that fourth beer, you know, I was starting to feel the effects. And I'd start into that dance hall. There'd be young girls sitting there, and I'd get in there, and I'd say, "Would you like to dance?" And she said, "No, didn't matter." "Would you like to dance?" Till I got one to dance with me. And then when they would dance with me, being a good alcoholic, I'd put on a real show for them. And they would say to me, "Geez, Lloyd, have you been drinking?" And I'd go, "Yeah." And they'd say, "How many did you have?" And I'd say, 12. I only had four, but it was 12 then. And you know what? I could tell you this. I can remember getting married when I married my young bride. By this time we had children, I come home more than half in the bag, drinking 12 or more, standing in the kitchen doorway, swaying just like Bill Wilson used to sway. And my wife giving me the eye and saying, "Lloyd, how many did you have?" And I'd say, 4. It changed fast. You know what? I know why those numbers changed. I figured it out. Because when I was that young guy, 17, I didn't know I had a problem. The number could have been 100. It didn't matter. But by the time I was 22, it mattered. I knew I had a problem. I started lying about how much I drank. We do those things. And I want to tell you a little bit about these mistakes I've made in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to get to principles and personalities a little bit. I don't know a lot, but I'll get there. The first mistake I made, I fell in love with you people. You took me in the way I was, and all you asked me was my first name, and that was it. And I qualified, I was in. And you know, I loved you people, and you just took care of me. And I started running the road with my buddies and everything like that. And I remember I was sober about 2 years. And when I was drinking, I used to drink in the Woodbine Hotel. That was a real classy place in Winnipeg, you know. It was on Main Street. Not too many people went there, but I did. I loved it. But anyway, I was sober 2 years, and I remember we were going to get my two-year cake, and I said to my wife, "Just imagine, I'm sober 2 years, I'm going to get a two-year cake." And she looked at me, and this is what she said. She said, "Yeah, you're sober, but you haven't changed at all." Yeah, that was a real slap in the face for Lloyd. It was a wake-up call. She said to me, "Lloyd, when you were drinking, I was a beer parlor widow, and now you're an AA, and I'm an AA widow. That's what's happened. I just run every day of the week with my friends because I loved you people, and you took me in. But I wasn't doing the program. I wasn't doing what I was supposed to do. So that was my first mistake. Second mistake I made, I was sponsoring a guy. I still sponsor him. He's an only child. His parents are getting up in age, and he was in my house this day, and I said to him, Gary, I suggest that you make amends to your mom and dad before it's too late. And my wife was home that day walking around. She must have heard some of this conversation. As soon as Gary was gone, you guessed it, she come up to me and she said, you know what, Lloyd, you're nothing but a hypocrite. Again, another slap in the face, and it just took my breath away. I didn't know what to say. I said, I don't know what's wrong. I don't know what you mean. Well, she said, where was our amends? Where's my amends? Where's the girl's amends? I said, do you ever hear of a living amend? Because people say those things in AA. I said, that one will work for me, you know. I'll stay sober, whatever you get, God bless you, you know. She wasn't happy, and I was panicking. I phoned up my sponsor, Austin Bradley, at that time. He's gone, and he was a beautiful man. He said, Lloyd, he said, you made a mistake. What does the big book say? Read the big book. When in doubt, read the book. Follow the instructions. That's the easiest way. And I read the big book. He said, what does it say? I said, it says direct demands. He said, you call that direct? You know what? I had to go. By this time, my girls were married. And I really didn't know what to say to my wife. After I was sober 19 years. Worked for 19 years. And you know, I had to go and make amends. And this one night I went to my eldest daughter's, took my wife was there, and her husband went out to play hockey. And I wanted my wife to know that AA is not BS. And what I did is I said to my daughter, Shannon, I got something I want to talk to you about. She said, what's that, Dad? I said, when I was drinking, if I ever hurt you, embarrassed you, made you feel uncomfortable, I'm very sorry. I love you and I care about you. She said, Dad, no problem. There's no problem. Everything's wonderful. I'm glad you're sober. I have no regrets. And the one I thought would be the easiest was the hardest. She let me in on a little secret. She said, Dad, I don't have a problem, but there's one thing. I said, what's that one thing? She says, you know, Dad, when you were drinking, you were very distant, but you're not like that anymore. And that's what alcoholism does. It puts up barriers in that home. You could live there, but you're probably not communicating properly. That's what happens. The lines of communications go down. And that's what happened in my home. And it took a long time to get it back up. And still today, I have sometimes to struggle with my great, beautiful bride with that. The other thing is, you know, I thought I was doing okay, and people would ask me, how's it going? I was surprised. I thought my wife and I'd have the perfect marriage after I got sober. It doesn't work quite like that either. I had to work at it, and people would say, how are you doing? Well, it goes good at work, good in the group, not so good at home. Keep coming. That's what they'd say. That's not the answer. The answer is, your mind recognizes a problem. What are you doing about it besides talking about it? We ended up going for counseling at an alcohol foundation. And you know, this keen alcoholic mind of Lloyd said this. When this guy told me to come down on a Monday and bring my wife, I hadn't even told my wife about it. Monday morning when I'm getting dressed up, she says, where are you going? I said, I'm going to see a counselor. She said, what kind of counselor? I said, marriage counselor. And I said, you better get dressed because it concerns you too. You know, she never said a word all the way down. That's no way to take your wife to see a counselor. But in my keen mind, when I was going down there, and I thought to myself, thank God somebody's going to finally straighten this woman out. Sober and thinking like that. And I'm telling you, I said, they're going to whip her into shape. She's in for a surprise. And he talked to us, and he was quite nice, and I noticed something. He was really nice to her. And then he said to me, I want to see you alone. Ooh. And you know what I found out? Didn't whip her at all, but he sure whipped me, I'll tell you. So I learned something there. But it's called growth. That's what that really is growth. And I want to tell you, how much time have I got left?
5 minutes.
Okay. And just only about maybe 6 years ago now, my wife never learned to drive a car. She's one of those that never learned to drive. I retired, I would drive her to work every day almost. My wife's quite forgetful. Sometimes she'd forget her lunch, she'd forget her jacket or whatever. This one morning, I was in a big hurry. I had just driven her to work. Get home. Telephone rings. It's my wife, Jude. And she says, Lloyd, she says, I forgot my glasses. Would you be good enough to bring me my glasses? You ever get those mornings you can't get out of the box? I do. I couldn't get out of the box. Somehow, I was in a hurry and this was bugging me. And I couldn't get out of that box. And this is what I said to my good wife. And she says, could you bring them down immediately? And I was just smoking. I don't know why. And I said to her, I'll bring them when I'm ready. Boom. And I'm telling you, I was sober quite some time. The phone rings. And who is it? It's my sponsor, Austin Bradley. And he says, Lloyd, how's it going? I said, I'll tell you how it's going. I said, that wife of mine, I just drove her to work. I get her there and I come back, I said, this goes on all the time. She says, Lloyd, can you bring my glasses? I said, you know, that woman, forget her head, it wasn't screwed on. And he just said, Lloyd. He says, that's your wife. You've been married a long time. And he says, what would you have done if I had a phone? You said, come on over. I said, come right over. He says, I know you wouldn't. You'd think nothing of it. I said, you're right. But he said, because your wife has just asked you to do that. He says, you're having a little hissy fit. I said, I guess I am. He said, Lloyd, he says, if something happened to your wife, I know that you'd drive those glasses back a million times to have her back, right? I said, right. He said, take the glasses. And I did, and I never said a word. Another lesson. And that's why you need a sponsor. If you don't have a sponsor, to me, it's like a loose cannon on a ship. That's what that is. And you know, they're talking about just principles before personalities, and I think some of it, I just had a little bit in my own group. You could probably tell by the personality I am. And what happened is, I guess I'm actually an original member of the group. And what happened is, sometimes we don't have a chairperson, we just have steering committees, and sometimes when it came time to do something, or like chair the business meeting, they say, hey, Lloyd, you mind chairing the business meeting? You do a real good job. And, of course, you stroke my ego. I'm more than willing then, right? And I said, yeah, I'll do that. And I was talking to my sponsor. And this happened a few times. And I mentioned to my sponsor, he said, Lloyd, he says, you think that's quite right? He says, you don't hold a position in the group. You're out in service. I said, that's right. He says, you know, Lloyd, you want to think about that carefully. He says, maybe we're doing somebody out of a job. I said, right. I could see what he meant. And that is part of, you know, when we do that, even though we do a good job, is to let somebody, we all got to grow and learn how to do that. So I just wrote out the instruction I gave to my friend Fred. I said, Fred, here it is. It's all up to you. And you know what? He did a bang-up job. AA was in good shape when I got here. AA is going to be in better shape when I'm gone, believe me. Anonymity. You know, every time we go out and we do something for the good of Alcoholics Anonymous to help somebody, we remain anonymous. That too is, you know, principles before personality. That's what that is. Because if you're like me, we get the big ego and we take the big ego trip. You know, that could easily happen. And I think one of the biggest ones for me was actually when Bill and Bob turned this whole thing right over to the trusted servants. You know, could you imagine if you were the co-founders and what would you say, you know? That, it was the greatest one, I think. And I'm just so pleased. And I want to finish with this. I have a dream. And this is my dream. And it's just my dream. And my dream is this. When I die, hopefully I'm going to go to the right place. And when I get there, they're going to say, who we got here? And they're going to say, Lloyd. And they'll say, Lloyd who? And they'll say, Lloyd the alcoholic. And they're going to put a little tag on my toe. And on that tag, it's going to say, arrive sober. God bless. Thank you.
Thank you, Lloyd. Our next speaker is actually our Area 53 Panel 59 delegate. She has graciously skipped the delegates' luncheon to be with her, be with us here today. So we appreciate that. Everybody, welcome Jean Ash from outside Columbus, Ohio.
Hi, everybody. I am Jean, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm just really thrilled to be here this week. It's, you know, what a gift to be able to be here sober and to participate and hear what you have to say and maybe give back a little bit of what's been given to me. So I'm thrilled to miss the luncheon. I don't think I needed to be there anyways. I've eaten a lot this week. But, you know, when I was thinking about this principles before personalities, I've had a few years to work on this, and I've had to work pretty hard on it because, you know, at first I was thinking, you know, when I was out there, I didn't have any principles. And the more I thought about it was, oh, yeah, I did. They were just all the wrong ones. And that's what got me here. I had some principles, and I always put my principles before personalities because I held these principles of mine near and dear, and I didn't care who you were. What I thought was more important than who you were. One of the ones I loved from a real young age was that of lying. I had very normal parents. They, well, if we have normal anything, but they were non-alcoholic, let's put it that way. And they did teach me values. They did teach me principles that I strive to embody today. But for some reason, from a very young age, if I wanted to do something that I knew was against what they would want, if I got caught, first of all, I would deny it. And then I would just continue to lie and lie and lie, thinking that, you know, if I say it often and loud enough and look you right in the eye, you're going to believe me. And it worked a lot of the time, unfortunately, because when it works, we keep doing that, you know, or at least I thought it worked. The other part of that principle that I just held very dear was rationalizing. If no matter what it was, I started to believe my own lies. And I remember hearing someone say, you know, the lie I tell you will be the fifth lie because I've told it to myself four times first. I really start to believe what my mind is saying. So no matter what it is, and this was from very young age on up, and especially when I was drinking, I could do this even better then, the rationalizing continued. I'm skipping around, but I remember reading in the grapevine, it was April, I don't know why I remember this, April 99, and it gave a definition of when an alcoholic hits their bottom, it's because events happen quicker than he can lower his standards. And I understand that. You know, I really, truly understand that. And it was, as I said, it happened from a young age on. I would lower what I thought was the right thing or was all right for me to do. And I put these principles into practice. It didn't matter who, as I said, you were. It didn't matter what the situation was. I had very little regard for you. What was yours, I felt like should be mine. If it was your husband, well, that's kind of, I'm not married, it's okay, you know. I would rationalize these kind of things. And I ended up hurting a lot of people. I had a lot of amends to make when I got to this program. And some of them I found out I couldn't make directly because I would probably injure people even more if they had known what I really was doing to them. I had another principle that was important to me, and it's that I wanted things done my way. And again, I thought I knew the best way. This committee in my head reasons, and they all talk, and they all decide this is what's the right thing. Of course, it's always very much slanted on what I want to do. So, again, if it's I should be home with my children, or let's see, choice B, I can be out working a part-time job, right, because we need money, bartending, and staying out till 4 and 5 in the morning. It's okay. It's okay to do that. Because why? Oh, that's right, I'm earning money. So, you know, it's my way. If you have a different opinion from me, you could tell me. But most people didn't more than once. You know, they just... I remember my son when he was actually sober at 14. And I was actually watching Alcoholics Anonymous work in his life through kind of a alcoholic haze. But I had seen the people in these rooms actually help him. I would drop him off at meetings and you would bring him home. And after... Well, I had things to do. I needed to go drink. And I did respect the program. He was able to read again. He could tie his shoelaces again. All kinds of wonder things. You know, 14-year-old, those are good traits to be able to have. But I still thought I needed things my way. And one time when my son actually came up to me and suggested that maybe I had a drinking problem. He never did that again. I explained to him I was a social drinker, and I really believe this. This is what's insane. I really believe that I was a social drinker because I was quite social every time I drank. And I explained that to him, and he just kind of nodded and walked out. I think he knew I was not ready to hear anything else but what I thought and do it my way. Another principle I really held close was that I needed to keep others out of my life. I thought that if I let you in my life and let you see who I am, number one, you probably are going to be, you know, making the sign of the cross and running, but you're not going to like who I am. If you could see me as I truly am, which I didn't even want to see, you're not going to have any respect for me. You're not going to want to be around me, because I very quietly and with a smile on my face did horrendous things to people. I guess one of the things, probably a bad thing, I always looked kind of normal, you know, and I got away with so much with that. And I thought if I could keep you out and make everything around me look okay, that it was okay. Again, the principle, lie to myself, rationalize, everything's fine. Doesn't matter that I've run through people's lives, that I've had two marriages, two divorces, two kids, that I'm just really wreaking havoc in their lives. I thought it was okay, and my principles held that true, that I was okay. The other thing was to keep you out and not feel. Because if I can't feel what or have any empathy for you or your situation or what I've done for you, then it makes it so much easier for me to do what I need to do for myself, to keep my selfish principles, to keep my self-centered life going on. And alcohol fueled it all the way. I had a huge appetite and a huge tolerance for alcohol from the very beginning when I started drinking at age 19 to 21 years later. I could imbibe at least a fifth or more a day and function and maintain and work and teach your children, which I apologize if any of you thought from that. I actually had a girl come up in a meeting. It was just awesome. I had led at this very small meeting, and she kept staring at me, and I thought her eyes looked familiar, but I thought it was from another meeting I'd known her. she came up and she had been a student of mine. And it was like, oh, dear. How do you make amends for that? But today, you know, I can look people in the eye and be okay with who I am and what I'm doing. As I got here to you because my second husband decided he needed to quit drinking, and I thought he did too. We had only been married 6 months. He had left his wife for me and his children. And again, I was single. Not my problem. And we got married, and I really didn't want to. I just wanted to drink and play a little, and I'd send him back to you. But he had a little higher standards and principles than I did, so we got married. And then very quickly I understood that he could not work anymore. He shook so terribly every morning, and we were both pretty much at the height of our disease of alcoholism. So I came to you because I wanted you to fix him like you'd fixed my son, and then I could leave him with you and go do my thing again and drink. That was how my principles were going to handle this whole situation. And the funny things happen, you know, when you are in these rooms. I don't care what kind of barriers you put around you, what kind of armor you have, the truth starts chinking at that if you sit and you listen. And thank God you just let me listen and absorb. Because if you had come up to me and said, you need a sponsor or anything else, I would have been out the door. You just let me listen and hear. And eventually I knew I was alcoholic. And I was just heartbroken because it's the way I lived. It was my tool. It was how I did everything every day with alcohol in my system. And I had no clue what to do. But I soon found out that the principles, the values I had that had brought me to you had to change. Because I was miserable. I was in pain. And I had nothing. I knew no way to get out of that. And I had some wonderful sponsors, and they started talking about working the steps. And as I got involved with those steps, which is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, my principles did start to change, and my life started to change. And you know, it's funny, you can get kind of hooked on that, because you start to see, wow, this works. And the more I work it, the better things become. The easier it is. I got involved in service early on, from washing coffee cups back when we had coffee cups to working, you know, becoming a secretary, treasurer, you know the deal. And then you go and make the fatal mistake of asking your group who's your GSR, and turns out you were. And my home group didn't even have elections or group consciences. They had the good old boy system. But that was okay because it got me even further involved in the program. I started to see that honesty, where I had had denial and lying and rationalization, it needed to be replaced with honesty. And you know, in the big book, or in How It Works, first paragraph, 5 times rigorous honesty. And if I cannot be honest with myself, I don't have a chance of being honest in my life or with my relationship with you. I can't have that principle be before your personality or mine unless I'm really willing to do the work and become honest and look at myself, which is not my favorite thing to do. It's still very difficult to really examine what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. The things about doing everything my way had to turn around 180 degrees to become willing to maybe look at how you do yours. What do you do to stay sober? What are your thoughts on this idea? What are your thoughts on this problem? I've learned so much as a delegate. You have no idea. And it's not anything I've done. It's having to have an ear to listen to you. To find out what you think about the items that come up. What do you think about spending this amount of money or making this pamphlet or maybe rewriting this thing? It's not about what I think anymore. It's about what you're thinking. And I've learned to listen. And I've learned to listen not just to people that I like. That's easy. You know, we always... It's both the people I don't particularly like. And you know what? In Alcoholics Anonymous, we can love everybody, but there's a lot of people maybe we just don't like real well. And that's okay. I don't have to live with you. But I do have to live with you in another sense. And I have to be willing to listen to you. And I have found out, and we hear about, if you've ever gotten into any of the things in the concepts and talks about, you know, minority appeal and listening to other people's ideas instead of just my own. And I've had my ideas change so drastically sometimes. I was sure I knew the way this should be. I'd done the research. I'd looked it up, blah, 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 blah. And then I hear somebody come up from a totally different angle and talk about what they've experienced, what they see. And it's changed my thinking. You know, it expands my thinking. And that's so important, I think, in Alcoholics Anonymous. The other principle I had about keeping you out of my thoughts, out of my life, pretty much, has had to turn around to one of trusting you. That's a huge principle that I think is important that we learn in Alcoholics Anonymous. To trust you, to have the best interests of not only me, but Alcoholics Anonymous at heart. And again, when I trust you, and I learned to trust event just from the very beginning, from maybe knowing you at a meeting, to talking to you over coffee, to maybe having a sponsor that I trust to share with honestly. So that trust becomes, I think, one of the legacies that we have in our program that's so important. And the principle that about not feeling, that it's important not to feel anything, for me has been replaced with a type of spirituality where I can embrace, my higher power lets me embrace and be happy with, getting the 3-minute warning sign. That's okay, because I can yak forever on this stuff. But it, to me, this growing in spirituality is what really brings me serenity. I heard Sandy B. say on a tape one time, well, it was actually in person, that if you have not grown spiritually in the last 5 years, maybe you need to look at that because you haven't changed. You know, you have not really grown in the principles. And the last thing that I would just say is about, I think, being willing to hear and know the truth in my life is probably one of the principles that I hold so dear. I want to just read this real quick to you. I found this, and when you go to the conference, a lot of us have little memorabilia that we make up to share with each other. And I had these bookmarks made up because I love this saying. It's from Bill Wilson, from Letters of Language of the Heart on page 264. And he said, how truth makes us free is something that AAs can understand. It cuts the shackles that once bound us to alcohol. It continues to release us from conflicts and miseries beyond reckoning. It banishes fear and isolation. The unity of our fellowship, the love we cherish for each other, the esteem in which the world holds us, all of these are products of the truth, which under God we have been privileged to achieve. May we therefore quicken our search for still more genuine honesty and deepen its practice in all our affairs. Thank you.
Thank you, Jean. And finally, we have Kathy G., from Bradenton, Florida.
Hi, everybody. My name is Kathy, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am happy to be here, and I'll be even happier in about 20 minutes. My sobriety date is August the 7th of 1993. Well, I suspect I'm the baby of the sobriety group up here. My home group is the Sherbet Group in Palmetto, Florida. We meet on Sundays at 1 p.m. under the pavilion at the Gamble Plantation State Park. It's beautiful. Come and join us, and we would love to have you. I found out about the opportunity to share on this topic about 3 months ago. And so about a week ago, I started preparing. And I finished up about 10:30 this morning. Some of the sources I used were a paper called The AA Tradition that was written in 1947 by Bill. The 12 Steps and 12 Traditions from 1952. The Language of the Heart, some of Bill W.'s grapevine writings. And The 12 Concepts, also by Bill Wilson. And, you know, our first two speakers were, I thought, wonderful and, you know, sharing freely of themselves. I have a difficult time, I guess, thinking that anybody really wants to know about me. And so what I've prepared is more directly about the principles of our program. When I think about principles before personalities, I think of Tradition 12 immediately, which says anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And that's like a really tall order. That's like a really broad subject. So I had a lot of trouble in the last week trying to figure out, you know, what it is that I can talk about a little bit that's going to make any sense. So the first thing I thought of was, well, what principles? And we know that we're guided by a set of 36 principles. Those are embodied in the steps, the traditions, and the concepts, 12 of each. All right? And the foreword in the 12 and 12 tells us that the steps are a set of principles, spiritual in nature, which if practiced as a way of life, have the capacity to expel the obsession to drink and render the alcoholic usefully whole. Usefully whole, man, that's something I wanted to be. You know, I wanted to be helping people. I wanted to tell people how to do things and what to do, and I didn't know how to do anything. You know, it's like when I confronted an issue, when an issue came up in my life, you know, it was like uncomfortable. I drank, and then it was fine. Anything that I could think of that, you know, like maybe what I would do, you know, that was illegal or immoral or anything would bother me until I drank. And then when I drank, I was like, I don't know what I was so concerned about. You know, what's the big deal? You know, I don't know. But we can hardly talk about the 12th tradition without also looking at the other traditions, because it does say it's the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. So the first thing that I learned in Tradition 12 is that the substance of it, the spiritual substance of anonymity, right? We're talking about anonymity, is sacrifice. It's like, I don't want to sacrifice. No thank you. All of our 12 traditions ask us to give up our personal desires in favor of the common good. So the problem is we have a natural desire for personal distinction, both in AA and outside of it. You know, I know that's true of me. Right? It's like, it really is all about me. You know, I know you don't really know that yet, but it is. It is all about me. And let me give you a little example that it's all about me. All right? When I first found out I was speaking on a topic at the International, I was like, I was very excited. Well, then I got like the preliminary agenda thing to see what rooms people were speaking in. And, you know, all of our area officers, which I serve as the area chair of South Florida, I have that privilege, but all of our area officers are speaking at something here. Well, they're speaking in the convention center. chopped liver? Jeez. See, it is. That's like one of my first thoughts. It's just automatic. You know, and if I don't share that with people and it rolls around in here, I just get sicker and sicker. Right? All right, so the thing is, if I'm going to put the common welfare first, I have to learn to practice true humility. But why? That is not easy, not easy. So let me talk a little bit about what happened in the early days with anonymity. Bill and Bob realized that the message of AA was not going to get out quickly enough or far enough just by word of mouth, that we had to have something else to be able to transmit our message. And rather than, you know, leave it to chance by some well-meaning AA person that liked it in front of the media and would expound on how wonderful AA was and how they got sober, and if it were me, you know, expounding on how big a part I had played in it. You know, rather than do that and that true nature of us coming out. Bill being one of the biggest offenders, by the way, for quite some time. But there came that time when they realized that if we were going to flourish, we had to have some kind of policy on public anonymity. And anonymity became and still is the cornerstone of our public relations policy. And because as an organization at that time, AA renounced personal glorifications in public, right? So it wasn't all about the person, it was about the movement. It showed the world who we were, and we came into favor in the public eye because we weren't promoting ourselves as individuals. You know, we weren't holding these interviews with the media and telling them, you know, seeking personal publicity, not all about me. We weren't any, you know, there's no hard sell like, you know, you've got to join AA or else, you know. We don't have the only answer here. You know, it's the answer for me, and I know it's the answer for me. It saved my life, you know, but it's not the answer for everyone. So there weren't any hard sell tactics, and there aren't any today. We don't claim to be the only solution. But because of that quietness and that modesty, you know, the public began to see us as, you know, there's something to this thing. There's really something to this thing. So there's differences in opinion about why we need to practice anonymity at the public level. So I might not be sensitive about my anonymity, perhaps, but there are a lot of people who are. You know, there are people who feel like if their anonymity is blown at the public level, that's going to affect their career, you know, and their lives, and they feel that their standing in the community could be jeopardized. But on the other end of the spectrum, we have people that want to, you know, shout their AA membership from the rooftops, or maybe more apropos in today's world, from the internet, right? I've seen in the past year one particular thing comes to mind, one member comes to mind, that they're well-known people, right? There's actors and singers and political figures and billionaires and people such as that. And they think that breaking their anonymity at the public level can help hundreds or thousands of people. You know, they feel like their motives are good for helping other people to find AA. They think they're doing more good than harm when they're you know, exposing themselves as members of Alcoholics Anonymous. But our co-founders warned us about this type of thinking. So if everyone felt free to market himself as a member of AA in public media, like on television or on the internet, Bill predicted this. He said, oh, he has such a way with words, we would soon be launched upon a vast orgy of personal publicity, which obviously would have no limit whatever, right? So let me move on a little bit. Love and tolerance is our code. from orgy, we're moving on. Get a little too personal there. How many times have we sat in a meeting where a newcomer thinks that every share is a dialogue, you know. It's like somebody says something, he's like, oh, yeah, you know, he talks. Yeah, you have. You've been there, haven't you? Or maybe where the meeting was a series of advice giving instead of sharing about our experiences. Or a home group business meeting where some newer member had an idea, but an old-timer squashed it because it was more convenient for the old-timer the way it was being done. Well, we've always done it that way. That's not a good idea. You know, where's the principles in all of that stuff? You know, that's practicing self-will, you know, and intolerance if we squash those kind of ideas and we're not tolerant of the people that don't know any better. You know, we can pull them aside later, or when we sponsor individuals, we can teach them about sharing their experience in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and we can show them by example how those things are done. Let's talk a minute about the seventh tradition. That's our principle of self-support. So routinely we see or are involved in a clash between members or groups. At least I see that, you know. And when we get particularly lively when we're talking about money, you know, we somehow think it's ours. You know, this is not my money. But we get narrow-minded, we get tunnel vision. And we think we have the answer to carrying the message of recovery. And we're so masterful at rationalizing why the idea will work, we fail to recognize that we're outside of our traditions in our thinking. So let me give you a couple of examples of that. Many groups meet in churches, right? We pay rent to the churches. We pay rent for in return for a service. We have a meeting space. We have, you know, lights and power, and we can make the coffee. We have the restrooms there. Okay, that's what we're paying rent for. But then we kind of get close to the pastor or some of the people in the church, or maybe some of our group members are church members too. And then this idea gets started about, well, you know, Pastor Joe has been so good to us. We ought to give him a donation to help him fix paint the building or fix the roof. We think we ought to do that with group money. All right. The church is an outside entity. We're paying them rent to meet there. They might be a worthy cause. And if I as an individual, want to make a donation to the church, I can make a donation to the church. But it's not appropriate for group money, self-support money, to be used to fund outside entities. It wasn't too long ago that I heard of a group that at Christmas time decided that Toys for Tots was a really, really good, worthy cause. And they took $500 of their group money and they donated to Toys for Tots. You know, this is not along the lines of self-support whatsoever. You know, and we can fall into these traps. We want the right things for Alcoholics Anonymous, but we forget the principles embodied in our steps, traditions, and concepts. You know, and we get into that, that self-thinking, that rationalizing, that justification. And if we follow, you know, if we follow along those lines, we miss opportunities to support AA through our contributions of funds and our participation. You know, we were talking about service earlier, and we need to give service. I need to give service to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, what better way to show my gratitude? You know, gratitude is not something I say, it's an action, right? And in giving service, that's an action of gratitude. And the thing is, we only have the one purpose, right? The primary purpose, to carry our message for the recovery of alcoholics. And sure, each group is autonomous, but it gives us an exception. Except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. And when we run our lives, and by extension our groups, on self-will, we're bound to affect people and entities outside of our group. So let's stick to our primary purpose. We don't have any business giving that seventh tradition money to these outside entities, right? Let me talk about rotation for a minute. We have a principle of rotation. You ever attended a meeting where you got one person that runs the meeting week after week, month after month? You know, maybe it's called Larry's meeting. Not a group here, right? It's a meeting, because if it's Larry's meeting, it can hardly be fulfilling any group functions. right? So pretty soon people start to talk, Larry does this, Larry does that, right? We don't like people dictating to us. So these types of meetings, they don't grow, and they don't offer the best opportunity for recovery and sobriety. Newcomers might stay for a little while, but pretty soon they realize they don't really care for this kind of personality-driven environment. You know, there's something about that other group down the road that they like better. You know, and what they like better is that group is practicing the traditions. They're practicing the principles. That's naturally attractive to us. And we have similar situations at our intergroup, at our district, at our area. You know, if we've elected an individual who power drives or at the opposite end, who has no leadership abilities, then we're likely to be less productive or even, you know, it can be chaos, right? We just get crazy, left to our own devices. Warranty 5 and Concept 12 explains to us that AA is not personally punitive to any member. Ugh, dadgummit. You know, because I want to be personally punitive sometimes to those members. I'll be like, what are you doing? Get your butt down from there. You are not God. You know, but if I'm a trusted servant in any capacity and I'm not practicing the principles, something's going to happen and it's not going to be good, right? Either I'm going to get drunk or I'm going to be miserable. That's just how it is. When we don't practice the principles, we get punished inherently because of our disease of alcoholism. So we don't have to be personally punitive. And when it's election time, guess what? The group can express their displeasure with their votes. They can vote me right the heck out of there. It's like, okay, you know, you've had enough. It's time to go. I might think that I'm moving on to something else and they just love me and they're going to, no, I'm out of there. Believe me, rotation is that magical elixir. You know, if it's bad right now, just wait. You know, just wait till the time of the elections come around. And it's absolutely astounding what can happen at rotation time. And, you know, if you haven't experienced this, it's a wonderful thing. Because you start to think that, oh, my God, what is AA coming to in this group, in this district, in this area? You know, this isn't right, and you know, it feels like you're beating your head against the wall trying to talk about the principles and the traditions, you know. But then then the elections happen and things begin to turn around, and before you know it, 6 months down the road, it's flourishing again and the morale is up and we're doing good things. Let me share one thing with you. That's a real-life example of principles before personalities in action. A few years ago, our area was kind of blindsided when we got a report from our regional trustee that one of our state conventions had gone severely in debt by tens of thousands of dollars. You know, we were just oblivious to this. And what happened in our assembly was we had some motions come up that proposed ways that we would take care of this debt, because we're Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's all that hotel saw. You know, the fact that Alcoholics Anonymous owed thousands of dollars to them. They didn't know that it was, you know, certain individuals that had been running the convention, you know, that didn't manage things properly. So because we're Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, we had to take care of that, and we knew we had to take care of it. But the ideas of how to take care of that were so varied and wide that it was difficult to get anyone to agree on anything. The area assembly got very heated. It was very passionate discussion. You know, remember, we're talking about money. And it's ours. Not. I had gone to that assembly, you know, thinking to myself, and I had just become an area officer. I was the recording secretary. And I said to myself, coming into that, I'm going to keep an open mind about this, and I'm going to listen to what everyone has to say, and we're going to come to a resolution. But what happened was I was sitting up there watching the discussion going on, and I found myself, when certain people would get up to the mic and they'd express a certain opinion, I'd be like, oh, my God, what are they talking about? No, that's stupid. And I caught myself doing it. I'm like, oh, my God, I do not have an open mind. My mind is so closed. Holy cow, you know, this is bad. This is bad. And what I saw was, you know, I mean, it got to, there was some loud discussion, right? But what I saw was this. I saw our trusted servants, a few of our trusted servants, and in particular our delegate at the time, hearing what the body was saying. And instead of sticking to his own idea about how we can solve this issue, he saw that the body had different ideas. And he helped the body move in that direction in the discussion. And ultimately, we came to a resolution that everyone could agree on. I got chill bumps just now just talking about it. It was wonderful. It was fabulous. I learned a huge lesson from that. Because when we stick to the principles, when we are not stuck on our own idea, and we can hear, and we can cooperate to bring it to what does the whole of AA want, how do we think we can do this, then we're practicing those principles, and we can help the suffering alcoholic so much better. You know, if AA as a whole has a black eye because of something some small group in AA has done, you know, we have a responsibility to take care of that. You know, because the world doesn't see a district or an area or a group. They see Alcoholics Anonymous, right? All right, I'll close now because I already got the three-minute warning probably 3 minutes ago. Let me just sum up a little thing here. AA must necessarily evolve to carry the message successfully to suffering alcoholics. But we have to learn to trust the most basic precepts and ideas upon which those really tenuous first years of AA were founded. We have to continue to embrace the 36 principles of our legacy, the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and the 12 concepts to ensure the survival of the program of recovery that's responsible for your life and mine. I have to be vigilant on my road to recovery, to always open my mind to what others in my group are saying, to immerse myself in living the steps, to learning and applying the traditions and concepts in my home group, district, and area, to speak up for the traditions and concepts even when I'm in the small minority. Because it's through personal inventory and a truly open mind that God can guide me in the direction of His will. Thank you.